Hello, everyone, and welcome to Energy Security Cubed. I'm your host, CEO and President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Kelly Ogle. On today's episode, recorded April 5th, is the recording from our webinar, Critical Infrastructures and Energy Systems in the United States. This webinar is part of a series on American security challenges funded by the United States Department of State. Please note that the opinions, findings, and conclusions stated herein are those of the speakers and the moderator only and do not necessarily reflect those of the United States Department of State. For most people, energy security and energy infrastructure are not top of mind. However, with the recent blackouts in Texas, the issue of energy infrastructure has become increasingly more salient. Are the energy systems in the United States sufficiently secure, resilient, and redundant? How can energy infrastructure be improved, and what can the U.S. glean from other countries and jurisdictions on this front? Canada, perhaps? I believe the devastating situations experienced in Texas and other southern jurisdictions were more than the perfect storm and point to a definite energy security concern exacerbated by infrastructure issues. We will dive deeper into this. Joining us today to discuss this are Jude Clemente and Adam Semensky. Jude Clemente is a CGI fellow and principal of JTC Energy Security Energy Research Associates, LLC. Jude is a frequent commentator on energy, having published energy-related pieces in a variety of outlets and contributed reports for a multitude of major energy research organizations. We're also very pleased to have Adam Semensky join us. He is the president of the King Abdullah Petroleum Studies and Research Center in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. He is also the non-resident senior advisor to the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Energy and National Security Program, the administrator of the U.S. Energy Information Administration's Senior Director for Energy and Environment, and on the staff of the United States National Security Council. That's a mouthful. We're certainly pleased to have Adam here. Jude and Adam, welcome.
Thank you very much for having us.
Hey, glad to be here, Kelly.
Let's get started. We'll get asked both of you to answer this question. As extreme weather events such as wildfires in California or freak winter storms in Texas increase in frequency, what can be done to make such critical energy infrastructure in the U.S. more secure? Jude, why don't you start?
Well, I think part of it is a potentially more diverse system. I think we saw this down in Texas. They've been in a situation there where they actually dropped in gas production was down about 45% during that particular event. The problem becomes Texas, of course, is a it's an energy market. It's not a capacity market like you have in PJM. So what's the incentive to weatherize? But I think we're already starting to see some push that the systems in Texas in particular need to be a little more weatherized as we, you know, move forward with climate change. Some of these events are becoming more frequent. The problem becomes, and I will use California as a quick example, you have the three big utilities out in California, the IOUs, spending about $22 billion to harden the grid, to harden the system out there. And that even includes controlled burns to get rid of potential brush for a fire. So that's going to be $22 billion that's not being spent, to prevent fires, wildfires, not necessarily being utilized for to build more solar and wind power. So that's a lot of money to spend, and it's not necessarily going to be used for climate goals. It's going to be more for hardening the system. So this is a very expensive process, and I just wonder where we're going to get the money for it, really. But I think another option, as well as more, is I do think we need more pipelines in this system, and I think that's something that's getting harder to build, especially gas pipelines. You know, gas is easily our main source of electricity here in the United States at about 40%. But again, in Texas, you had a situation where there wasn't the supply, because production was down, we need more storage as well, gas storage. I'm actually in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it's kind of a new development here. The shale gas, we now produce about 20% of the US gas supply is in my region. It's kind of a new thing. It's only been around for 10 or 12 years. So we certainly need more storage, especially in this region of Appalachia, which is becoming increasingly important because we are actually shipping out a lot of our gas to other states that don't produce gas, but they use it. So this is a very expensive and complicated process. So I'm not saying I have all the solutions, But I think that some of it there is hardening the system, especially as more renewables come on. We need more spinning reserves. So to me, one of the problems as well is the pushback on natural gas might put us in a little bit of a predicament, because wind and solar, of course, are great. Everybody wants more wind and solar, but they are naturally intermittent. And that is something I think that is kind of gets lost in the conversation. They're mostly not available most of the time.
Adam, what would you like to add to that? Because I know in some prior discussions I've had with you that, and you know, using the jurisdiction you're currently in as an example, you know, the natural gas, I think, is really in the playbook for Saudi Arabia, correct?
It is, but let me your question start off with Texas and California, weather events, climate related, natural disasters, hurricanes are always an issue in Texas as well. But there are at least five other aspects or risk categories for infrastructure, energy infrastructure, that are probably worth just listing. Jude talked about physical security and resilience. There's aging infrastructure and trying to find a way to deal with that. That's going to be expensive, I think Jude said. There's cybersecurity, and that is increasingly, I think, a worry for everybody. There's even workforce development issues. Kelly, you were joking about the two old guys here on the panel. There's a lot of retirements coming up, and this is an issue that I think has actually concerned the energy industry for the last 5 or 10 years as they see their workforce aging and younger people not necessarily coming into the energy arena. And the last category is one that I always kind of have a laugh about, is Donald Rumsfeld and the unknown unknowns. I mean, there are some things that we just don't know about, and that's one of the reasons why infrastructure resiliency is important to deal with the things that bite you that you weren't expecting.
Jude, I'll ask you first. As much as competing pundits tried to blame the problems on wind turbines versus going back to the Texas issue and other jurisdictions, on wind turbines versus natural gas infrastructure, is there a heavy reliance on any one single form of energy? I think you did touch on this a bit about gas, and thus one form of energy infrastructure the problem?
I don't think it's necessary. I think there was a problem across the system, really. It wasn't just, like I said, gas production was down about 45% in the state of Texas. So you can do anything you want. If you don't have the supply, that's going to be a problem. And a lot of it comes from, too, as you go into winter, there definitely was some frozen wind turbines, but ERCOT goes into winter with about 25,000 megawatts. That's the power operator in Texas, with 25,000 megawatts of wind. They only expect about 6,000 of that to be available. So it certainly was, sort of a low expectations for wind, but then they perform a little better maybe in spring and in summer. But I don't think necessarily, you know, you can blame it one source, like you're saying. I think it was kind of a failure across systems. And that's something that, you know, when you think about Texas as well, I actually think of the word restrained. And let me explain why I think of that, because since 2010, Texas's own gas production has been up 40%. It's marketed production in the state of Texas to around 25.3 BCF per day, somewhere in that range. But their gas capacity in the state of Texas has been the same at about 67,000 megawatts of gas generation capacity in the state, even though their gas production, what they're actually pulling out of the ground, has boomed. They have not over-relied on gas to the benefit of surrounding states that import a lot of gas from Texas. And also now globally, because Texas is at the heart of our LNG boom. So a lot of states should be thanking Texas that they're not over-relying on natural gas. They very easily could have. And I use Massachusetts, and I'll use Florida as well. Massachusetts and Florida do not barely produce any gas at all. Yet gas generates over 75% of their electricity. So Massachusetts doesn't produce a gas, but they use it for their generation system. So to me, Texas has actually showed a lot of restraint over since the shale revolution over the past 10 years by not over relying on gas. And gas only supplies about 45, maybe 50% of the state's electricity. That's right on target with California, if you can believe it. California is about 45, 50%, depending on the hydro situation. It varies every year. So I think Texas is an excellent example of not over-relying on one source. And they've really gone to wind and solar more so than gas, even though gas is still the main source in Texas.
Adam, would you like to add to that? Because, you know, maybe part of that is and I don't want to get too into the weeds, but part of it is the markets in Texas and Texas is sort of a closed system when it comes to electrical generation. Can you expand on that, Adam?
Yeah, let's start off with that one. The ERCOT region in Texas, that they decided some time ago that they didn't want to have federal interference in the electricity sales in the state. And so to accomplish that, they were limiting the amount of cross-state border transmission. So when the shortages appeared for a number of cascading reasons, and we might come back to that, it was virtually impossible to get help into Texas from any of the surrounding states, like Louisiana, or even wheeling across Louisiana from other states that did have capacity that could have been used. The cascading issue, I think, is one that kind of comes back to the infrastructure risk issue. They had natural gas wellhead freeze-ups so that the gas couldn't flow out of the wells. When electricity was lost, it turned out that some of the ways of moving natural gas around in the state required electricity, and they weren't prioritized, and so the ability to move gas around was compromised. There were all kinds of things, frozen coal piles that prevented the coal units from being able to utilize their coal stocks. And there was even a nuclear power plant that had a water kind of control line that froze up, and the nuclear plant had to go offline because they weren't getting the proper signals from the generating turbine. So it was one of those things where if it could go wrong, it did. And I think the combination of all of those things created a real mess. Consumers didn't have electricity, they didn't have heat, and then the water systems were failing as well. So there were really unfortunate personal health issues associated with this failure across the state. I suspect that they've learned lessons from this, and I imagine that this isn't going to repeat.
Yeah, let's just stay with this because, as you know, hopefully the listeners know that in the energy systems in the federal system of the United States are controlled by each state, as is Canada and the provinces. And I think that, you know, integration and collaboration are paramount here. There has to be some kind of a come to the party colloquial. To use a colloquial, let's get together on this. Let's expand on that discussion. Adam, are the states talking to one another here? Is this all still siloed? What's the future look like?
Yeah, well, I think a number of the states that are in electricity regions where they're together do have the opportunities to talk, and there are other forums that allow for that. You know, one of the interesting things, and it's a Canada-U.S. issue, is the amount of electricity that flows into the northeast part of the United States from Canada is actually quite significant. And even into the Midwest from Saskatchewan, there's quite a bit of Canadian power that comes across the border. And so I think that that there are many people in the United States that probably don't realize the dependencies that exist, not just from state to state, but from Canada. There are even some connections between the U.S. and Mexico, not nearly as significant as in Canada, but all of North America is probably better off if you can figure out a way to make the grid work across all three of the countries.
Well, and without diving too deep into the pipeline issues and the current debates in the public policy world about pipelines crossing Canada, i.e. Keystone XL and the Line 5 into Sarnia. Jude, could you expand a little bit on, you know, I've been pounding the table for years about a North American energy strategy and, you know, make the continent an island. And you have a vast and broad depth of knowledge about Mexico, Jude. Can you take that a little further on this infrastructure discussion?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's no question about it. It's essential. I mean, when you look at what's happening around the world, you have consumer China dealing with supplier Russia. You have big consumer India dealing with supplier Iran. So that's just one example. I mean, you have these countries working together. It's absolutely essential. And I agree with you, Kelly. I've been saying this for a while too, to have a more like an aligned North American energy markets. And as Adam was saying, it's not just pipelines, it's power. Hydropower from Canada is now coming in, you know, to meet clean energy goals. Mexico is critical because Mexico is part of the IEA now, it's the OECD, but it doesn't, it has a huge upside in demand. Mexico is still, in my opinion, a still developing country. So the demand side of things, half of Mexico is deemed or categorized as in poverty. So there's a huge upside for incremental demand in Mexico, much more so than it is in the US and in Canada, you know, you could say fully developed countries. Mexico is still developing. So Mexico, in a population of 135 million people, young population as well. Canada or Mexico has a younger median age than the U.S. in Canada, obviously. So there's huge side there. Unfortunately, what's happening in Mexico now is you have a president that has really gone back on, you know, sort of this resource nationalism that was supposed to go away. And now he's sort of given hesitation to developers in Mexico, you know, people coming in and investing in the country's energy market. He's gone back to favoring Pemex, oil and gas company, and also CFE, which is the power company, utility, the state utility in Mexico. So he's giving mixed signals about this situation of, you know, sort of pushing out outside suppliers, which really Mexico needs. They are very, Pemex is in debt over $100 billion. They don't have the experts to get to a significant shale resource that they have. And also they have deep water opportunities. They need experts from the outside to come in and sort of help and also invest in the country as well. And he's given these mixed signals now in the reforms that took place in 2013. They're starting to look, you know, like they might not, you know, materialize here. And you have a situation where the new president or AMLO, of course, president, he only serves one term. In Mexico, you get one term for 6 years. That'll end in 2024. But you're already having people talking about, we can't wait till he's out of there. And it's an unfortunate situation because he's sort of been talking out of both sides of his mouth on this situation. But yeah, Mexico is key to this as well. And you have Canada now looking to export, obviously, from, you know, this Kelly from the West Coast. They really need to reach the Asian markets. That's where the growth is really in demand in particular, you know, with LNG Canada, the new project up there that's going to come online in a couple years. So you have a couple factors that are kind of pushing against this alliance that we need. And I'm hoping, you know, it materializes eventually here, but we're starting to see some signs that there's a little bit of a problem. Keystone XL as well. I mean, that was what was tragic about that situation, in my opinion, was that they committed, the operators committed to using renewable energy to power that pipeline. So that to me is saying, well, we don't want to be part, you know, we're not going to allow the oil and gas companies to be part of the climate solution. That's a huge problem because oil and gas supply 70% of our energy in the United States combined. So they have to be part of the solution, or we're never going to get this, the climate problem solved, if we're going to push out companies that are committed to using renewables for their operations. I think that was a very unfortunate situation there with Keystone XL.
So Adam, this speaks to the whole discussion. You and I discussed earlier that, you know, Saudi Arabia has these massive goals of decarbonization, And, you know, the fundamental tenet of energy security is at what cost? Because it's a, you know, it all revolves around that. We can have all of these holistic and aspirational goals we want, but what does it cost? And, you know, in the, you know, Mexico is a direct, that's a perfect example of, you know, the misallocation as much as non-allocation of capital. So what are the plans in the Middle East to decarbonize, and what could we possibly, because are there things we could learn from what you're seeing in places like Riyadh?
Well, one of the things that is underway in Saudi Arabia, and it was actually endorsed by the G20 summit leaders back in November, when Saudis were hosting the G20 summit, is a framework or platform that we call the circular carbon economy. The idea of the circular carbon economy is dealing with carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions in a way that preserves that, a more pragmatic and practical approach that you were talking about, Kelly. It's the idea is to take the three R's, reduce, reuse, and recycle, that come from the circular economy, and add a fourth R, remove, and then it becomes applicable to the energy area. But let me come back to the point that you were making, you know, what we're trying to do in all of this. And it is an infrastructure issue that we're talking about here today. If all you do in terms of trying to deal with climate change and the temperature rise is try to ban fossil fuels, you're probably making a huge expensive mistake. There are at least three major problems associated with just focusing on hydrocarbons alone. You have an infrastructure that would be underutilized: ports, pipelines, power plants, and you know, even automobiles that take more than a decade to turn over. You'd have reduced energy access. So access and reliability is still a huge issue for many, many people around the world. The numbers that are come up again and again in every investigation and survey that's done is there's at least a billion people that don't have electricity. There's another billion that don't have clean cooking fuels. And finding ways to deliver that is really, really important to both the economy and health. And then finally, there are some sectors that are just really hard to abate. Aviation, for example. Shipping, transportation, particularly heavy trucks, and then some of the heavy energy using industries like metal smelting, cement, and so on. So finding a way to allow all of these options to be considered legitimate, by all of the options, I include the renewables in that. There is a big renewables program underway here in Saudi Arabia. There is a big efficiency programs underway in the kingdom. But you have to go beyond that. You need recycling of carbon dioxide. You need reuse of carbon dioxide and things like enhanced oil recovery. And you need remove options, whether it's nature-based solutions like trees or in this area, mangroves, which are actually pretty efficient absorbers of carbon dioxide, and even things like direct air capture, and overlaying all of this hydrogen and its, you know, many, many colors: green hydrogen, which comes from renewables, and blue hydrogen, which uses natural gas. I think that the way I summarize this is to say, look, if you're going to build a house, you need more than just a hammer. You've got to use all of the tools in the toolbox to get the job done. And people who think that you're going to be able to fix this issue with just one tool, you know, renewables, I think are making a, as I said, a very expensive mistake.
Jude, we talked a bit about, you know, the use of renewables and the need for large infrastructure. I don't think there's there's lots of capacity to build wind and solar, especially in climates like we see in the background where Adam's sitting, and or the United States, the greater Midwest of the United States. Like, is there a place and a time for legitimate, big, large public-private partnerships to build? You know, I'm going to use the interstate highway system as an example. Like Chicago, the greater big Midwest cities need lots of energy, and more specifically electricity. Is there something that can be done to combine and collaborate on wind, for instance, to and or big infrastructure projects like transmission lines?
Yeah, maybe the private public question, maybe Adam could answer that better. But my thoughts on that would be certainly the Midwest. Obviously, that's the Great Plains. And we talked about Texas having, you know, producing like 25-30% of the U.S. wind power, where they have a great resource. So it, California is 40% of the solar generation is, you know, California based. So they have sun. I lived in San Diego for 8 years, and I'm now in Pittsburgh. We don't have the sun that San Diego has, obviously. So there needs to be a recognition as well that not every resource, every state has the same resources. This is why the Southeast does not have renewable portfolio standards, because they don't have the wind resource that other states have, like someone like a state like Texas or the Midwest. So getting that Midwest wind into the population centers, we need a huge transmission build out, not just transmission lines for power. They're high voltage transmission lines. It's a very expensive process, but a hard process. It's hard to site transmission in the United States. A lot of times it's harder than to build a pipeline. The good thing about the transmission situation is it's bipartisan support. You saw this with the package that the Biden administration just came out with, $2.3 trillion. It's kind of a bipartisan support thing to build these transmission lines. And something that nobody's talking about, really, to get more wind and solar into the system, is this whole idea of electrification, I think, has gone under discussed. And by that, I mean electric cars. You saw how much money is involved in, you know, building electric cars, building them here. Not, you know, the raw materials are hard to get for batteries. China controls a lot of these supply lines. But the bottom line is, you know, electric cars are a growing field big time. What's that going to do to our power demand when you talk about electrification for electric cars, for industry, for buildings? You're seeing these gas bans in California. You're not allowed to have hookups to gas. You have to use electricity. What's that going to do to our power demand, which has been flat for 12 years? I bet you a lot of Americans don't know that. Our electricity demand has been flat since the Great Recession at about 4,000 terawatt hours per year in that range. So what's this going to do? An electric car could increase home power usage by 50% or more. That's what's really, you know, people are discussing this. Some people say it's 20%. Some people say it's 60%. But I can tell you that the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, they come out with their electrification future study. It comes out, I think, every year. They've said this process of electrification could increase our power usage here in the United States, our power demand, by 65%. And every state is going to have to double its generation capacity. Just think about that. So every state, this is the National Renewable Energy Laboratory saying this, that we're going to have, every state is going to have to double its capacity. So Adam is exactly right. The idea that it's just going to be wind and solar is fantasy. I mean, you heard what Bill Gates said the other day about thinking outside the box. Hydrogen and carbon capture and storage, all these different things need to be part of this, and transmission lines as well, because we could be at the beginning of a boom in U.S. electricity demand, and nobody's talking about it. We need demand response to limit that, and I think there's some good possibility there for demand response. But the bottom line is our electricity demand could be going up in the coming decades pretty significantly, and that's something I think a lot of people don't discuss very much, is that potential of that happening.
I'll just add that, you know, if anybody wanted to have an electric car in their home, they don't, there's the other, just the individual cost alone of putting a 220 amp service in your house is probably a $2,000 to $3,000 cost alone, not counting the car or the other electricity you need. Just the service alone is probably $2,000 to $3,000. right. for the electrician to come and do that. So, you know, people are, I got to think folks are going to balk at that.
Well, one of the interesting things about this is that even if you did that, if on your, you know, where you live, if 4 or 5 or 6 of your neighbors do the same thing, you might not have the capacity on the local, your literally your streets transmission lines to bring that amount of power in at any given time. There have been some studies done that say the overall effect on energy won't be great, but it'll shift things around. Less gasoline use, for example, and more electricity if you have electric vehicles. And the question is, well, where does that gasoline go, and how do you get the electricity where you need it? Kelly, you asked about public-private partnerships, and you know, in the U.S., is kind of the way that seems to happen the most is when the local policymakers come up with ways to try to push a particular form of energy, and in some cases, it's pretty useful. The shale gas revolution actually got its start with the $1 a million BTU tight gas credit that was in place for a while that helped fund the technological innovation that ultimately drove hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling and so on. Now what we're seeing is that the 45Q section of the U.S. tax code is encouraging experimentation with carbon capture and storage, and that could have a very good ending too. So those times where the government gets together with private industry and says, we're trying to drive a new technology, what can we do to help? I think does indeed have an opportunity to pay dividends. The difficulty comes, of course, in trying to choose what things that you're going to push, and sometimes you push the right things and sometimes you push the wrong buttons. But it's a democracy, and democracy is sometimes negative. In general, and let me conclude with this, I think that with the pandemic relief packages that are under consideration, some have already passed, others are being considered by governments around the world. The phrase that a lot of people are using is build back better. You know, can we get local communities to drive their own recovery? Can we include fairness and equity in the build back better solutions? How do we really avoid repeating the mistakes of the past? And that's where Texas, I think, has got to do some serious work. And then finally, I think in all of this spending that's going to happen with Build Back Better, I think we all have to hope that it will really result in reducing risks and building resilience into our energy systems. I tend to be optimistic. I think it's going to happen, but things like that generally require some supervision, and I hope everybody that's listening in tonight will pitch in. Back to you, Kelly.
Jude, would you add to that?
Well, to me, I think that's what it comes down to is, and this was something that Chevron had put out as well, and they took a hit on Twitter for it, but it is kind of true. They I think it was Chevron. They tweeted out, might have been Shell, so don't quote me, but it was one of the majors. Basically, I don't want to get anybody in trouble, but it was sort of, you can Google it real quick. It was sort of like, what are you going to do on climate change? What decisions are you making in your life? And they got absolutely lambasted for saying that. But that's really at the heart of it. Like, what are you going to do in your life? We're concerned about climate change, poverty. Adam, I talked a little bit about poverty. That's a whole nother discussion that I really like to talk about, because it's a very sad thing what's happening globally. 85% of the world is still living in still developing countries. They don't live in Berlin and Los Angeles. They live in poor countries around the world. It's a very sad thing. And that's a huge deal to me, is energy poverty. And nobody talks about that. I think it's been completely forgotten. Energy, in my opinion, I've been on this subject for a long time. Even the energy companies themselves have forgotten about it. But when you talk with Americans, and you talk Europeans and even Canadians, no offense to you, Kelly, but it really is at the heart. What are you doing in your life to change it? And this comes down to what you think of electric car is good for climate change. How can you get electric car? Take a bus. All these different things, you know, instead of driving, you know, the American hallmark is driving, personal mobility since Ford's, you know, Model T. It's been a hallmark of our society. So, you know, they came out and they really got in trouble with that tweet, but it's really the heart of it. And I think the younger generation doesn't want to hear, younger than me, of course, but I don't think they want to hear that. And that's unfortunate because that really is at the heart of it. We have this giant problem. And people say, well, no, it's up to the oil and gas companies to solve it. That's not true. The oil and gas companies are not, the oil and gas problem in the United States, people using oil and gas, is consumers. I wrote an article years ago, or a couple years ago, it said Exxon isn't the oil user, you are. We are as Americans. So what are you, or Canadians, what are you gonna do to lower your footprint? And yeah, it's not gonna be cheap. But I think that just kind of shows that, you know, how they got in trouble for making this comment. What are you going to do in your own life? That's what it's about. And these poor countries as well, which again constitute the majority of the world, the idea that we're going to limit energy from them, I think is a little bit, has a moral bankruptcy factor to it, especially for natural gas. Let's not forget, the International Energy Agency has specifically cited the U.S. use of natural gas as to why we are lowering our emissions faster than any country in the history of energy. So to block natural gas from poor countries, the still developing countries, which again is 86.7 billion people live in still developing countries, we're going to limit natural gas from them. I find that morally just wrong, basically.
I'll say reprehensible, Jude. I can't thank you folks enough for participating with us today. This has been wonderful, and we look forward to more of the same. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of Energy Security Cubed. You can find the CGI Network on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give us a rating. You can also support us by donating at cgai.ca/support. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Energy Security Cubed is brought to you by our team at CGI. Thanks go out to our producer, Seth Scott, and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Kelly Ogle. Thanks for joining us on Energy Security Cubed.